Chapter 11. And thrust his hands deep into his pockets. Wolcott sat with his head down, watching Mason hopelessly, almost indifferently, his face blank and sunken. The ticking of the bronze clock on the mantel shelf was loud, painfully loud. Suddenly Mason drew his knees in and bent over, put both his bony hands on the table, and looked at Wolcott. "Sir," he said, "this matter is in such shape that there is only one thing to do. This growth must be cut out at the roots, and cut out quickly. This is the first fact to be determined, and a fool would know it. The second fact is that you must do it yourself. Hired killers are like the grave, and the daughters of the horse leech. They cry always, 'Give, give.' Apostrophe, apostrophe, they are only palliatives, not cures. By using them you swap perils. You simply take a stay of execution at best. The common criminal would know this. These are the facts of your problem. The master plotters of crime would see here but two difficulties to meet. A practical method for accomplishing the body of the crime. A cover for the criminal agent. They would see no farther, and attempt to guard no farther. After they had provided a plan for the killing, and a means by which the killer could cover his trail, and escape from the theater of the homicide, they would believe all the requirements of the problems met, and would stop. The greatest, the very giants among them, have stopped here, and have been in great error. In every crime, especially in the great ones, there exists a third element, preeminently vital. This third element the master plotters have either overlooked, or else have not had the genius to construct. They plan with rare cunning to baffle the victim. They plan with vast wisdom, almost genius, to baffle the trailer. But they fail utterly to provide any plan for baffling the punisher. Ergo, their plots are fatally defective, and often result in ruin. Hence the vital necessity for providing the third element, the escape ipso jure." Mason arose, walked around the table, and put his hand firmly on Samuel Wolcott's shoulder. "His must be done tomorrow night," he continued. "You must arrange your business matters tomorrow and announce that you are going on a yacht cruise, by order of your physician, and may not return for some weeks. You must prepare your yacht for a voyage, instruct your men to touch at a certain point on Staten Island, and wait until 6 o'clock day after tomorrow morning. If you do not come aboard by that time, they are to go to one of the South American ports and remain until further orders. By this means your absence for an indefinite period will be explained. You will go to Ninas and Croix in the disguise which you have always used, and from her to the yacht, and by this means step out of your real status and back into it without leaving traces. I will come here tomorrow evening, and furnish you with everything that you shall need and give you full and exact instructions in every particular. These details you must execute with the greatest care, as they will be vitally essential to the success of my plan." Through it all Wolcott had been silent and motionless. Now he arose, and in his face there must have been some premonition of protest, for Mason stepped back and put out his hand. He said, with brutal emphasis, "not a word. Remember that you are only the hand, and the hand does not think." Then he turned around abruptly, and went out of the house. 3. The place which Samuel Wolcott had selected for the residence of Ninas and Croix was far up in the northern suburb of New York. The place was very old. The lawn was large and ill-kept. The house, a square old-fashioned brick, was set far back from the street, and partly hidden by trees. Around it all was a rusty iron fence. The place had the air of genteel ruin, such as one finds in the Virginias. On a Thursday of November, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, a little man, driving a dray, stopped in the alley at the rear of the house. As he opened the back gate, an old Negro woman came down the steps from the kitchen, and demanded to know what he wanted. The drayman asked if the lady of the house was in. The old Negro answered that she was asleep at this hour, and could not be seen. "That is good," said the little man, "now there won't be any row. I brought up some cases of wine which he ordered from our house last week, and which the boss told me to deliver at once, but I forgot it until today. Just let me put it in the cellar now, Auntie, and don't say a word to the lady about it, and she won't ever know that it was not brought up on time. The drayman stopped, fished a silver dollar out of his pocket, and gave it to the old Negro. Here now, Auntie, he said, my job depends upon the lady not knowing about this wine. Keep it, Mum. That's all right, honey, said the old servant, beaming like a May morning. E cellar door is open, carry it all in, and put it in the back part, and nobody ain't never going to know how long it has been in dar. The old Negro went back into the kitchen, and the little man began to unload the dray. He carried in 5 wine cases, and stowed them away in the back part of the cellar as the old woman had directed. Then, after having satisfied himself that no one was watching, he took from the dray 2 heavy paper sacks, presumably filled with flour, and a little bundle wrapped in an old newspaper. These he carefully hid behind the wine cases in the cellar. After a while he closed the door, climbed on his dray, and drove off down the alley. About 8 o'clock in the evening of the same day, a Mexican sailor dodged in the front gate, and slipped down to the side of the house. He stopped by the window and tapped on it with his finger. In a moment a woman opened the door. She was tall, lithe, and splendidly proportioned, with a dark Spanish face and straight hair. The man stepped inside. The woman bolted the door and turned round. Ah, she said, smiling, it is you, senor? How good of you. The man started. How else did you expect? He said quickly. Oh, laughed the woman, perhaps the archbishop. Nina, said the man, in a broken voice that expressed love, humility, and reproach. His face was white under the black sunburn. For a moment the woman wavered. A shadow flitted over her eyes, then she stepped back. Oh, she said, not yet. The man walked across to the fire, sank down in a chair, and covered his face with his hands. The woman stepped up noiselessly behind him, and leaned over the chair. The man was either in great agony, or else he was a superb actor, for the muscles of his neck twitched violently, and his shoulders trembled. Oh, he muttered, as though echoing his thoughts, I can't do it, I can't. The woman caught the words and leaped up, as though someone had struck her in the face. She threw back her head. Her nostrils dilated and her eyes flashed. You can't do it, she cried. And you do love her. You shall do it. Do you hear me? You shall do it. You killed him. You got rid of him, but you shall not get rid of me. I have the evidence, all of it. The archbishop will have it tomorrow. They shall hang you. Do you hear me? They shall hang you. The woman's voice rose. It was loud and shrill. The man turned slowly around without looking up, and stretched out his arms toward the woman. She stopped and looked down at him. The fire glittered for a moment, and then died out of her eyes. Her bosom heaved and her lips began to tremble. With a cry she flung herself into his arms, caught him around the neck, and pressed his face up close against her cheek. Oh, Dick, Dick, she sobbed, I do love you so. I can't live without you. Not another hour, Dick. I do want you so much, Dick. The man shifted his right arm quickly, slipped a great Mexican knife out of his sleeve, and passed his fingers slowly up the woman's side until he felt the heartbeat under his hand. Then he raised the knife, gripped the handle tight, and drove the keen blade into the woman's bosom. The hot blood gushed out over his arm, and down on his leg. The body, warm and limp, slipped down in his arms. The man got up, pulled out the knife, and thrust it into a sheath at his belt, unbuttoned the dress, and slipped it off of the body. As he did this a bundle of papers dropped upon the floor. These he glanced at hastily, and put into his pocket. Then he took the dead woman up in his arms, went out into the hall, and started to go up the stairway. The body was relaxed and heavy, and for that reason difficult to carry. He doubled it up into an awful heap, with the knees against the chin, and walked slowly and heavily up the stairs, and out into the bathroom. There he laid the corpse down on the tiled floor. Then he opened the window, closed the shutters, and lighted the gas. The bathroom was small, and contained an ordinary steel tub, porcelain lined, standing near the window and raised about 6 inches above the floor. The sailor went over to the tub, pried up the metal rim of the outlet with his knife, removed it, and fitted into its place a porcelain disc which he took from his pocket. To this disc was attached a long platinum wire, the end of which he fastened on the outside of the tub. After he had done this, he went back to the body, stripped off its clothing, put it down in the tub, and began to dismember it with a great Mexican knife. The blade was strong and sharp as a razor. The man worked rapidly and with the greatest care. When he had finally cut the body into as small pieces as possible, he replaced the knife in its sheath, washed his hands, and went out of the bathroom and downstairs to the lower hall. The sailor seemed perfectly familiar with the house. By a side door he passed into the cellar. There he lighted the gas, opened one of the wine cases, and, taking up all the bottles that he could conveniently carry, returned to the bathroom. There he poured the contents into the tub on the dismembered body, and then returned to the cellar with the empty bottles, which he replaced in the wine cases. This he continued to do until all the cases, but one, were emptied, and the bathtub was more than half full of liquid. This liquid was sulfuric acid. When the sailor returned to the cellar with the last empty wine bottles, he opened the fifth case, which really contained wine, took some of it out, and poured a little into each of the empty bottles in order to remove any possible odor of the sulfuric acid. Then he turned out the gas, and brought up to the bathroom with him the two paper flour sacks and the little heavy bundle. These sacks were filled with nitrate of soda. He set them down by the door, opened the little bundle, and took out two long rubber tubes, each attached to a heavy gas burner, not unlike the ordinary burners of a small gas stove. He fastened the tubes to two of the gas jets, put the burners under the tub, turned the gas on full, and lighted it. Then he threw into the tub the woman's clothing and the papers which he had found on her body, after which he took up the two heavy sacks of nitrate of soda and dropped them carefully into the sulfuric acid. When he had done this, he went quickly out of the bathroom and closed the door. The deadly acids at once attacked the body and began to destroy it. As the heat increased, the acids boiled and the destructive process was rapid and awful. From time to time the sailor opened the door of the bathroom cautiously, and, holding a wet towel over his mouth and nose, looked in at his horrible work. At the end of a few hours there was only a swimming mass in the tub. When the man looked at 4 o'clock, it was all a thick murky liquid. He turned off the gas quickly, and stepped back out of the room. For perhaps half an hour he waited in the hall. Finally, when the acids had cooled, so that they no longer gave off fumes, he opened the door and went in, took hold of the platinum wire, and, pulling the porcelain disc from the stopcock, allowed the awful contents of the tub to run out. Then he turned on the hot water, rinsed the tub clean, and replaced the metal outlet. Removing the rubber tubes, he cut them in two pieces, broke the porcelain disc, and, rolling up the platinum wire, washed it all down the sewer pipe. The fumes had escaped through the open window. This he now closed and set himself to putting the bathroom in order, and effectually removing every trace of his night's work. The sailor moved around with the very greatest degree of care. Finally, when he had arranged everything to his complete satisfaction, he picked up the two burners, turned out the gas, and left the bathroom, closing the door after him. From the bathroom he went directly to the attic, concealed the two rusty burners under a heap of rubbish, and then walked carefully and noiselessly down the stairs, and through the lower hall. As he opened the door and stepped into the room where he had killed the woman, two police officers sprang out and seized him. The man screamed like a wild beast taken in a trap and sank down. Oh! Oh! He cried. It was no use. It was no use to do it. Then he recovered himself in a manner and was silent. The officers handcuffed him, summoned the patrol, and took him at once to the station house. There he said he was a Mexican sailor, and that his name was Victor Ancona, but he would say nothing further. The following morning he sent for Randolph Mason, and the two were long together. IV, the obscure defendant charged with murder, has little reason to complain of the law's delays. The morning following the arrest of Victor Ancona, the newspapers published long sensational articles, denounced him as a fiend, and convicted him. The grand jury, as it happened, was in session. The preliminaries were soon arranged, and the case was railroaded into trial. The indictment contained a great many counts, and charged the prisoner with the murder of Nina San Croix by striking, stabbing, choking, poisoning, and so forth. The trial had continued for 3 days, and had appeared so overwhelmingly one-sided, that the spectators who were crowded in the courtroom had grown to be violent and bitter partisans, to such an extent that the police watched them closely. The attorneys for the people were dramatic and denunciatory, and forced their case with arrogant confidence. Mason, as counsel for the prisoner, was indifferent and listless. Throughout the entire trial he had sat almost motionless at the table, his gaunt form bent over, his long legs drawn up under his chair, and his weary, heavy-muscled face, with its restless eyes, fixed and staring out over the heads of the jury, was like a tragic mask. The bar, and even the judge, believed that the prisoner's counsel had abandoned his case. The evidence was all in and the people rested. It had been shown that Nina San Croix had resided for many years in the house in which the prisoner was arrested. That is, he had lived by herself, with no other companion than an old Negro servant. That her past was unknown, and that she received no visitors, save the Mexican sailor, who came to her house at long intervals. Nothing whatever was shown tending to explain who the prisoner was, or whence he had come. It was shown that on Tuesday preceding the killing the Archbishop had received a communication from Nina San Croix, in which she said she desired to make a statement of the greatest import, and asking for an audience. To this the Archbishop replied that he would willingly grant her a hearing if she would come to him at 11 o'clock on Friday morning. Two policemen testified that about 8 o'clock on the night of Thursday they had noticed the prisoner slip into the gate of Nina San Croix's residence, and go down to the side of the house, where he was admitted. That his appearance and seeming haste had attracted their attention. That Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.